The views and opinions expressed on this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents. For more information on this or other talk shows, log on to our website at kuci.org. Welcome to this May 21st, 2014 edition of Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at kuci.org, and we are always available via podcast. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. As always, Writers on Writing is dedicated to the art and business of books. Each and every week, we're here with authors, agents, poets to talk about craft and content and writing. I'm joined this morning by Alice LaPlante, and coming up in the second half hour, Zachary Lazar will be here with me to chat about his novel, I Pity the Poor Immigrant. Alice LaPlante is an award-winning and best-selling author of five books, including the LA Times bestseller Method and Madness and the New York Times bestseller Turn of Mind, which was a New York Times editor's choice, a number one indie next pick, a Barnes & Noble Discover Award finalist, and the winner of the Wellcome Trust Book Prize. She teaches creative writing at Stanford University, where she was a Wallace Stegner Fellow and a Jones Lecturer. She also teaches in the MFA program at San Francisco State. Her latest novel is A Circle of Wives. It's published by Atlantic Monthly Press, and we'll chat about it and hopefully more this morning. Alice, welcome.
Oh, I'm so pleased to be here.
Thanks so much for coming on. So I'm going to let you take us into your world of polygamy and murder and what inspired you to write this novel.
Okay. Do you want me to read
now? I love
now,
polygamy.
Or do you want me to just
It? Yeah. Just talk about it. Just tell us a little bit about the scope of what the novel's about, and you know, some of the characters, and kind of what got you excited about writing it. What inspired it?
Well, about 8 years ago, I read just this little brief article in the local paper up here at Stanford that a Stanford doctor had died at a fairly young age of a heart attack, and when he died, it came out he had three wives. And that just always intrigued me, because what it said about people and their relationships and what they're satisfied with and what they're looking for. So it was always in the back of my mind. And when it was time to write a new novel, I decided to take that as a jumping-off point. I didn't do any research into the actual event. I just creatively explored the material. So my novel's about, he's also a doctor, and he dies of a apparent heart attack in a hotel room, but it turns out he has three wives. And so the book is told from the point of view of each of the three wives, but also from the point of view of the young detective who's assigned to the case.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. How often does that happen for you, that you take things from newspaper articles or things that you're reading, or is that typically how it starts?
You know, it can start in any number of ways, something that happens to me personally that resonates, or something I read, or something someone tells me about that sticks. Just anything that has some mystery to it is really what inspires me.
Yeah, yeah. And how far do you have to get into a project to know that it's got enough legs to sustain it as a novel? I mean, are there some of these that you start and you say, you know, you get 50 or 70 pages in, you're like, huh, didn't quite work out.
Yeah. Unfortunately, you can go pretty far before you realize that. I wasted years on a novel, only to realize it was dead, it wasn't working. So you don't always know right away. I was a couple hundred pages in before I realized I had to kill it.
Oh. Is there any way that you can mine that for other things, or is it really all just dead? I guess it's good writing practice, but...
You know, that's a great question. I find that nothing ever goes to waste, that if I've spent time on it and imagined my way into a character, say, or a setting, that there's always something I can take and use later. So I've often taken bits of short stories that I just didn't publish for one reason or another and put them in my novels. It's funny how that works, how there's this sort of synchronicity, you know, in everything you write.
Yeah, thank God, right? I mean, a couple hundred pages, God. Let's talk about unreliable narrators, because in Method and Madness, you had talked about sometimes unreliable narrators can be used to get at deeper truths. And I know both in Turn of Mind and in this book, you you do make use of unreliable narrators, and I find them so fascinating. So talk a little bit about that, what the unreliable narrator gives you, and if they're hard to write, and sort of, you know, tips and tricks for writers who are working with unreliable narrators.
I love unreliable narrators. They're so fun because you're not tricking the reader, but you're giving them a puzzle to solve. Unreliable narrators, if you think about why you would want to do that, why you would want to tell a story from the point of view of someone who's not reliable, you have to think that you have to know there's many ways to be unreliable. Basically, anytime you write from first person point of view, you're writing from an unreliable narrator because people are inherently unreliable. They can be unreliable in terms of, you know, they can tell lies, but they can be unreliable in that they're not smart enough or they're not morally developed enough to see things the way they should. Some of my favorite unreliable narrators, like the Chief Broom in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, he's crazy,
right.
But he's telling the story, and because of who he is, he's crazy, but he has integrity, and you get that integrity in the telling of the story, which is just wonderful. And I think for writers who want to use an unreliable narrator, the number one question is, how do I let my readers know what's real and what isn't? Because you can't just throw them into a crazy world with no markers or nothing to hold on to. So you've got to use devices to give the readers clues about what the real world is like, even though the person telling the story is giving you a skewed view. So one way to do it, like the way they did it in One Flew Over the Cuckoo's Nest, was the dialogue was reliable.
Mm-hmm.
Chief Broom would imagine strange things in his mind and almost hallucinate, but if there was dialogue in the novel, you knew you could trust it. So the story was told through this fog, but the dialogue you could depend upon. And in my book, Turn of Mind, I used a journal where the main character, the protagonist and the narrator has Alzheimer's, and she's losing her mind. So she's very unreliable, and she gets more unreliable as the novel progresses. And the way I tried to help readers understand what reality was is, she would write down things in this journal before she would forget them. Other people would write things down in this journal to help her, or maybe to trick her. There were wheels within wheels. So there are different devices you can use.
It's really interesting. Now, with all of these characters, I guess you could say that all of them, in some sense, were unreliable. And did you know that going in? Or, I mean, there are some in here that are more unreliable than others. I don't want to give too much away about the novel. But how much did you know about their unreliability, or was that revealed to you over time in writing them?
I'm a very intuitive writer, so I don't know anything when I go into a book. Everything is a surprise to me.
I love that. I love that. And this notion of unreliable narrators being able to get at deeper truths, I really like, because we talk a lot on the show about fact versus truth, and you know, how fiction can often tell the truth better than nonfiction in a lot of ways. And so this notion that unreliable characters can get at something deeper and something more profound, I think, is also really interesting.
Yeah, like the narrator of my mind just went blank. Benji, the Faulkner novel.
Oh, right, in Sound and Fury.
Sound and Fury. I mean, talk about an unreliable narrator. He's mentally challenged, and he doesn't understand, even when people are playing golf, what it is. But he can describe the ball rolling, and he can describe the stick hitting. And so we find out that his descriptions are just meticulously truthful in a world where no one else is telling the truth.
Mm.
And that's a very interesting way of doing things that Faulkner tried.
Yeah, yeah, well told. My guest this morning is Alice LaPlante. You're listening to KUCI on 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are talking about her latest novel, A Circle of Wives. So the novel is told from several different points of view, as you mentioned, the wives' point of view as well as this detective's point of view in a variety of ways. So talk about accessing the different voices, whose voice may have given you more difficulty, and maybe how character and voice are different from each other.
Well, I was very conscious that the voices had to be very distinct. So as the characters were revealed to me, I was looking for ways that their voices, as I wrote it, that their voices were giving me clues to their character. Like I noticed that when I was writing from MJ's point of view, and she's kind of this neo-hippie who's the second wife of the doctor, I was using a lot of run-on sentences, a lot of comma splices. Mm. And so when I noticed that, I thought, okay, this could be a distinctive characteristic of hers. I'll be careful not to do this with the other characters. And Sam, the detective, uses a lot of double negatives in a kind of a humorous way. Mm-hmm. And so I found these little verbal tics, and they help me into character as well as distinguish the characters from each other. And you asked something else about how character differs from voice. Boy, that's a tough question. I'm not sure I know how to answer that because I think they're pretty close to each other.
Yeah, yeah. I keep asking that question and everyone says the same thing. I don't know. I just figure I'll keep throwing it out there and see what happens. Yeah, they are pretty close. I mean, I think it's hard to get away from yourself. And that's the beauty of being a novelist, right? Is that you get to try on all these different personalities, like, you know, some schizophrenic person, you get to be somebody else all the time. And I really like this notion of using punctuation and a sentence structure as a way of getting into character. And, you know, this double negative concept that Samantha employs, she is always using these double negatives. And you wonder what about her psychology that reveals that if, you know, she kind of thinks in a double negative sort of, you know, double negative sort of way.
Right.
It's very, very interesting. Let's talk about any of these characters who were problematic to you, characters that you disagreed with. Because the lovely thing about this novel, I think, is that it would be very easy to pass judgment on these people. You know, they're in a morally, ethically, what a lot of people would consider, you know, heightened situation of polygamy. And you know, some of these characters are complicit in the polygamy. But, you know, certainly there's a lot of infidelity going on. And yet you don't pass judgment on these characters. You see you kind of see the reasons behind it and the motives behind it. And that's really lovely. And I was wondering if we could chat a little bit about if any of these characters were harder for you to access from a moral, ethical point of view, and what you did to kind of get inside of them to make them more human.
Yeah, you know, I'm going to answer the question, but I'm going to take a step back first and say when I'm teaching, the criticism that I will not allow in a workshop is I did not like the characters, because that to me is not valid. It doesn't matter if you like characters or not. What matters is if they are interesting. And so when I hear that, I want to probe further. You didn't like them. What was the problem? You didn't feel empathy for them. You didn't understand. You know, be more specific. You know, because you think of the great, horrible narrators of literature, Humbert of Lolita, Little Alex of A Clockwork Orange. I mean, you don't like them, but you're just so fascinated by them that you just keep going. So, so that's my little diatribe on why it drives me crazy when people say I don't like the character. Yeah. So having said that, I think the only way in to make a character likable or have empathy for it is through understanding them, through giving them glimpses into what motivates them, what's driving them, and then at least you have some insight, and you can maybe even have a little compassion for them.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to, in my first novel, Turn of Mind, the main character was also, you could call her not very likable. She made a lot of errors in her life. She did a lot of not nice things, but I was so invested in showing this narrator deteriorating and showing what it did to her that I think it brought out a lot of empathy. In this novel, A Circle of Wives, I think that the character I had the most trouble with was Deborah, the first wife.
Mm-hmm.
She's really far from me. She's very controlling. I don't want to give too much away here. she's very straight-laced. She's very judgmental, and it was hard at first for me to understand where she was coming from. Mm-hmm. And so what I did is I actually wrote a lot of pages that didn't make it into the novel about Deborah, about her backstory, about her children, and that helped me a lot to understand her.
That's really good. Yeah, I was wondering if you kept kind of notebooks or big, you know, pieces of butcher paper or something about the characteristics of each of these characters so that you can kind of keep them straight. And I mean, they're such distinctive people that it wouldn't be that difficult to keep them straight in your mind. But yeah, kind of their background. And, I've heard of authors keeping scrapbooks about their characters or things like that, you know, help them know their history and where they're coming from.
Yeah, that could be very helpful.
Yeah. And all of these characters are so distinctly drawn. You know, they're very, there's no confusing them. My guest this morning is Alice LaPlante. The novel is A Circle of Wives. I'm going to give you a chance to read to us from this so that we can go into it a little bit deeper. Can you read to us?
Sure. I'm going to read to you a brief passage from the point of view of Helen, the third wife. And she'd only been married to the doctor for about 6 months. When she found out through an obituary that he had died. They had a commuter marriage because she lived and worked in L.A. So the section I'm going to read, she's the funeral is over. She's waiting in a car outside John's first wife's house for the reception to begin, the after-funeral reception. And she's just thinking about things. So here we go. As a pediatric oncologist, I know grief. I've witnessed it in its rawest form, for nothing good ever comes from the death of a child. There are no mitigating circumstances. There are no words that comfort. She's no longer in pain, comes close perhaps, but little else. I've been through this with parents dozens of times. You might consider that I would be inured to it. But no, sitting in my hot rental car in front of my husband's house on a leafy Palo Alto street, I suddenly know the intimate meaning of the word grief, bereavement, bereft. So this is it, I think. The moment before I'd been considering a new case, a patient, 6-year-old Cecilia, who'd been suffering from what seemed like a prolonged bout of flu. I'd probed further, bleeding from the gums, that's bad. Frequent nosebleeds, that's worse. The lab report has just come through by email. Not good results, actually terrible results. That's the problem with these mobile devices. Bad news come in all the time. Should I inform the family of the results? My colleague wrote in the email. 10 minutes later, only after I've repeated the words family and lab and results until they are meaningless, do I realize how big the hole that's been blown in my heart by John's death and by his infidelity. I roll down the window and try to fan some air into the hot car. I don't want to approach the house yet. I've somehow beaten the crowd here, and rather than knock on the door too early, I settle in to wait. The house surprises me. It's a majestic colonial with white columns in front and a circular driveway edged with verdant bushes. A manor house from the deep south, Tara. John had lived here, had been here when he wasn't with me, not in some funky Victorian on Potrero Hill in San Francisco, as he'd led me to believe. He must have been indulging in a fantasy when he talked about his San Francisco home, how the original anaglyptic wall decorations were still intact, how the tall wooden windows wouldn't open. He'd been so convincing in his stories of the ancient plumbing, of the termite infestation. I'm stunned by the elaborateness of his fabrications. Such lies require much forethought. He'd spoken of nights staying up until 3 a.m. doing dictations, pausing intermittently to admire the lights of the city below. He'd even described the pad thai of his favorite late-night delivery restaurant, and how the noise from southbound 101 troubled him on evenings when the wind blew due south. He'd drawn me a picture of life brimming with innocent busyness. We'd be sitting on the sofa talking lazily about ourselves, still in that state of discovery, and these things gradually came out. And all a fantasy. No, that's too kind. It was a con.
So good. That was Alice LaPlante reading from her novel, A Circle of Wives. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. Let's talk about generating suspense, because you do it well. So generating suspense for yourself as a writer versus perhaps generating suspense for the reader. And at what point you knew yourself who the killer of this doctor was. Don't give the killer away. But is it the same process of generating suspense for you as it is for the reader?
You know, it's almost exactly the same. I say almost because you have to do some craft to get it to work for the reader. But I feel, and I tell my students all the time, that writing down something you know already, completely know in your head, you're going to end up with something so dull, no one will want to read it. You have to be going on a journey of discovery yourself, or the reader won't accompany you. It's like Frost said, no tears in the writer, no tears in the reader. So I always like to explore mystery, and usually in my books, I'm ending up writing mysteries. There's two mysteries. There's the real mystery of who done it, and then there's the more the character mystery of why done it. Mm-hmm. And suspense, technically, if you think about it, is just partial knowledge. It's if you're in a house and a boogeyman jumps out of the closet, that's not suspense. That's surprise. But if you're in the house and the boards are creaking and you hear noises from around you that you can't quite place, and if it's a movie, the music gets a little spooky, then you start having it's partial knowledge. Partial knowledge that something of dramatic significance is about to happen. So when I'm writing, I'm learning as I write what's happened, so it's very exciting to sit down every day and find out what's going to happen next. But then I always have to go back and plant these clues as subtly as I can to make sure that the reader gets the suspense as well.
Is there a difference in your mind as you're writing about the whodunit versus the why they done it? Component, because there's so much psychology in this, as well as, you know, just the unfolding of a murder mystery. And I'm wondering if those two threads in your head, the psychology portion versus just the straight mystery portion, are distinct threads, or if they're kind of tangled up in your head as you're writing it, or, you know, do you follow those lines? Am I making any sense?
You're making a lot of sense.
Thank God.
You're making a lot of sense. I have to say that I don't, my work doesn't, if someone is an avid mystery reader and they pick up one of my books, they're going to be disappointed. It doesn't follow the genre formula. And so I like to say that I use the mystery as a framework. for bouncing off characterization. It's the characters I'm interested in, not the mystery. But I do think the mystery keeps people turning the pages. Unlike a lot of literary fiction where there's very little plotting and little suspense and it's all characterization, I think it has trouble engaging readers. And we could talk about what a shame that is. But I think if you want readers, you have to find a way of engaging them. And I've chosen the mystery as a way of doing that myself. There are other ways. When I, the way I got into this, I'd been trying, I just killed that first novel that I was trying to work on. And about 2 weeks later, I had just come back from a trip to Chicago. My mother had Alzheimer's, so I was traveling between Chicago and San Francisco quite a lot. And it had been a brutal trip, and I was just kind of collapsed. And my partner said, you know, let's watch some Friday Night Mystery on PBS. And then he said, why don't you write a mystery? Wouldn't that be fun? And I said, I couldn't write a mystery. But then I thought a minute later, but wouldn't it be funny to write a mystery where the detective had Alzheimer's but couldn't remember the clues?
Hmm.
And so that's how Turn of Mind got born.
Hmm.
And then I just found myself doing it again this time. But I think, you know, the character always comes first.
Right, right. That's wise words. Before we take off, your book Mystery and Madness, am I getting that right? Method and Madness, of course. Are there pieces of wisdom or advice that you could pull out for some of our listeners who are writers themselves that we didn't cover today, or other writing advice that you give your students that you found particularly useful to them?
I think the most practical thing you can say to writers is it sounds really stupid, but you should be writing. And if you're having trouble writing, use exercises, use prompts. They are invaluable. Every writer, even established writer that I know, uses them when they're stuck. You know, and there's plenty of prompts out there. There's books of prompts. My book, Method and Madness, has, you know, tons of exercises at the end of each chapter, but you can find these exercises everywhere on the web and use them. They're invaluable.
That's great advice. That's great advice. And where do we find you on the web? There's no blog of your sort of teaching and excerpts from Method and Madness, is there? There's no place to find some of your own exercises online. I was searching around looking for them because it's a textbook price for the Method and Madness.
I know. Oh, actually, there's a secret. Don't buy the textbook. Don't buy Method and Madness. There's a book. Norton, in their infinite wisdom, made two versions of the book. One is called The Making of a Story, A Norton Guide to Creative Writing. And that's a trade book. So it's really cheap. It's under $20.
Oh, good point.
So I'm teaching, I never assign the textbook because that's too expensive. It's just the markets that they went into.
Because all of our writers are poor, yeah.
Okay. Yeah, good. Yeah. So The Making of a Story, look for that, and you'll get all my wisdom for very cheap. It's the same book.
Love it, love it. And we can find you online. You have a website, Alice LaPlante.
Yeah, alicelaplante.com.
Wonderful. Alice, thanks so much for taking the time this morning. This was great.
My pleasure.
Thanks again. That was Alice LaPlante. The book, A Circle of Wives, is out and available now. We're going to take a very short break, but please stay with me. Novelist Zach Lazar will be joining me for the second half hour. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We'll be right back.
Thank you. this program do not reflect those of KUCI, its management, or the UC Board of Regents.
Welcome back to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. We are broadcasting live from the University of California campus in Irvine. We're streaming on the web at KUCI.org. This show will join the other interviews up on the web and available to you via podcast. You can find us on iTunes. We're under College Radio. Or you can always visit Barbara's website, penonfire.com, for direct downloads, as well as information on past shows, upcoming shows, speaker series events, and more. Everything is up on that website. I'm your guest host, Marie Stone. Onward with the show. I'm joined now by Zachary Lazar. Zachary is the author of three previous books, including the novel Sway, chosen as a best book of 2008 by the Los Angeles Times, Rolling Stone, Publishers Weekly, and Newsday. Zach is the recipient of a Guggenheim Fellowship and the Hodder Fellowship at Princeton University. He lives in New Orleans, where he's a member of the creative writing faculty at Tulane. His latest novel is I Pity the Poor Immigrant. It's published by Little Brown, and it's the subject of our chat this morning. Zach, hi.
Hi, Marie. Nice to talk to you.
Thanks so much for coming on. So you said in your 2009 memoir that you wrote Evening's Empire about your father's murder that you've always had two ideas, that one day you would have to write about your father's story, and that if you ever did, you would never be able to write anything again. So we're so fortunate that that didn't prove true.
Well, so. Thank you. Yeah, I mean, I did mean that sentence when I wrote that sentence. And fortunately, rather than closing down everything, it actually opened up things for me. So in that sense, that book was useful in many ways, but that way in particular.
Yeah. Yeah, so talk about that. Talk about how that story opened up, because you can see certain parallels and themes running through some of your work. Obviously, some of your ideas continue to percolate over time. So talk about how that opened up into I Pity the Poor Immigrant.
Right. Well, you know, I it's been a long road towards the kind of subject matter that I have ended up dealing with. And, of course, the reason for that subject matter is my father's murder, but I was avoiding that for a long time as a writer, and that wasn't really the kind of writer I wanted to be or the kind of subject matter I wanted to deal with, and I didn't think that I was necessarily going to be very well equipped to take on that kind of subject matter, but as things happened over time, over a long period of time, actually, I just found out that this is what I was supposed to be writing about. This was where the hot spot was for me, whether I liked it or not. And so when I was researching the book about my father was murdered because he was giving testimony against this land fraud artist in Arizona with whom he had had an association. And he was giving testimony and was murdered by two mafia hitmen because of that. And doing the research for that book forced me to look into organized crime for the first time really in my life. I mean, we all know a little bit about it from movies and TV and that sort of stuff, but I got to know quite a bit about it, and out of all that research came the figure Meyer Lansky, who started to take on this kind of glow for me and interest, and started to get kind of compelled in that direction. And once I get compelled in that direction, after a certain point, there's no going back. And so I kind of ended up sticking him in a novel. The original idea was to put him in a novel with the biblical King David. And the idea was to kind of forge this bizarre juxtaposition between two tough Jews. One would be a modern figure, one would be an ancient figure, and see if that could say something about Israel, maybe.
Yeah, right. Bold.
yeah, or stupid, yeah. The fine line, actually, between those two things.
No, it's amazing. It's amazing. I mean, I think the so many interesting things come out of putting two unlikely figures or two unlikely things up against each other, and those juxtapositions create all of these interesting, I don't know, lines and tensions and, you know, connections, and I don't know, it's well done. It's well done.
Thank you.
Somebody, yeah, I think it was an article in the or review of this in the New York Times that observed that this novel is put together more like a piece of music than like a traditional novel. And certainly, you know, the title of the book and titles of your other books come from musical lyrics. Do you think about that in structuring your books, that it's more more lyrical or more composition-like than novel-like?
I don't really think of it that way, but I mean, when somebody points it out to me, of course, oh yeah, of course. I do a strange mixture of fiction and nonfiction, and I never try to be, you know, really innovative or break the rules for the sake of doing that. I just try to tell the story in as an interesting and engaging a way as I can figure out, and that usually ends up meaning that I don't do it the normal way. But I'm always trying to, I'm really, one of the things I learned from a teacher I had a long time ago, Frank Conroy, was to always be thinking about the reader. And then I think that actually goes back to E.B. White, who said that to somebody. But, you know, so I always want to kind of try to be interesting and a little bit challenging to the reader so that they are doing some work, because I think that's flattering and it's interesting. Mm. And out of that desire to give the reader some thinking to do, I end up writing these books in sort of strange ways, I guess. But always trying to be coherent. And I guess the musical analogy is sort of true. I mean, I kind of have this feeling of shape and form that is hard to put your finger on, sort of in the way that a piece of music is.
Yeah, right. Yeah, your notion of blending fact and fiction, I think it's so... it's lovely to see the jumping off points where you have real characters and invented characters and real books embedded in fictitious contexts. And are you very aware of the jumping off points when you are going to leave the factual world behind and jump into imagination, and where you decide to take that leap and what facts you need kind of, you know, embedded and what facts you're allowed to play around with? Do you have kind of a rule set in your head for that?
I do. I mean, I don't allow myself to work outside the facts as we know them. And so where I can go and kind of be more imaginative is the places where we don't have any information. You know, I can fill in the gaps sort of, but I don't invent stuff whole cloth. I mean, there are writers who do that, and they can do it very well with real people. I mean, E.L. Doctorow is a guy that does that. But my little thing is more about trying to use the technique of fiction. When I'm writing about real people, trying to use the techniques of fiction to bring life to that subject in a way that is unavailable to a more traditional nonfiction kind of writing. You know, to imagine my way into them, try to get inside their skin and their head, and make them more palpably alive. Unless, you know, a lot of times the people I write about are sort of mythic, rock stars or gangsters or what have you, or stereotypical, and so I try to work against that. That's how I justify it anyway, using the imagination to try to make a new kind of portrait of these people.
Yeah, right. Yeah, I like this this notion of kind of the legacy of violence that follows all of your work, and it does seem to be what kind of connects the novels and the memoir. And I'm wondering, if do you find violence, that writing it is sort of an antidote to it, or do you think that it kind of extends the legacy in your mind, or does it quash it, or I don't know, does am I making any sense here?
Yeah, I mean, there's a tension, I think, between wanting to kind of understand violence, and by understanding it, hopefully bring some meaning to a realm of experience that is usually meaningless and very destructive. And obviously there's that on one side, and then on the other side, unfortunately, there is a natural and cultural tendency to romanticize violence. And it just is no matter what the story is, going back to Homer, I mean, violence is a part of stories frequently. It's inherently dramatic. And so as a storyteller, I think a lot of storytellers are drawn to it as subject matter just for that reason. Mm-hmm. In my own case, I guess, because I have this personal thing with my father and violence, that's not quite enough. I need to complicate a little bit, because I need to, I don't want to feel like I'm exploiting violence. I want to feel like, if I am exploiting it, I also want to be trying to work towards some sort of meaning or reconciliation with it.
Right. Yeah, I mean, that was kind of my observation, is you have some really amazing passages, some fairly violent passages, but it always feels like it's not gratuitous. It's always going towards some sort of goal, and you're right, it's not sort of romanticizing it, but it is calling it out for what it is. You know, it is jarring. It's jarring.
Yeah. Well, you have to do that.
You have to do that. Yeah. Yeah. It's similarly writing the Holocaust. You know, is there any trepidation around writing something that's sort of been written about a lot, fresh ways to come in and work with it, or does it feel like a very organic, you know, this is just part of the story, and I'm just going to report the facts as it serves the story?
Yeah, I had a lot of trepidation about it, actually, and for just the reason you just mentioned. I mean, it's just so many people have written about it well and firsthand, and it sort of had to be in the book because one of the big themes in the book, of course, is sort of victims and perpetrators, and sometimes victims becoming perpetrators. So the Holocaust had to be part of that equation, and it's not really in the book a lot. You know, I just sort of, I don't think it really needs to be in there a lot because we all have so much background about that anyway. So I just tried to get it in there with a few sidelong details or something.
Yeah, 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 so nice. Nicely done. My guest this morning is Zachary Lazar. The book is I Pity the Poor Immigrant, and you're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. A big chunk of this is written in Israel and about Israel. I thought it was very funny that I learned that you're Jewish, although you didn't know a lot about Jewish history or Israel when you started writing this. So I assume there was a research component in visiting Israel as you were writing. Is that true?
Yeah, a steep learning curve, sort of. I mean, I did grow up with some Jewish education, but not a really intense one. And as far as like modern Israel, it was something I knew very little about, honestly. And since there are so many people out there who fixate on Israel and know everything about Israel and think about hardly anything else, I knew that I really had to do my homework and try to get it right as best I could. And I went to Israel twice to do research trips for this book. And, one of those trips, I finally realized that I have to get it right, but I don't have to be the definitive spokesperson about what this is all about. That wasn't my project. I didn't have to have an answer to the problems of the Middle East. I had to just sort of present it as I saw it, kind of. You know,
if you could answer the problems of the Middle East, though, that would be very helpful.
Yeah, it would, right? Probably more helpful than a novel. Yeah. I'll think about it.
Yeah, if you could write a novel on that, that'd be really great.
Yeah.
So you're did King David sort of become? You said that you started with that, with this notion of, you know, putting these two characters kind of up against each other. Did that story become some sort of framework for the book, or did you kind of, you know, work that story in the aftermath? Or kind of tell me about structuring the book and structuring that idea in with it.
Well, you know, we were talking about music before a little bit, and writing this book. This book changed more than any other book I've ever written from the beginning to where it ended up being. And it was this big improvisation, sort of. And so I originally didn't know how I was going to work King David into this modern day story. And I tried to write these biblical themes and stuff like that. And they were disastrously bad. And I guess I finally realized that the David story was important as a sort of, in a metaphorical way, less than it was in a kind of, I need to dramatize everything about the King David story. And so after a while, I went back to the drawing board and I invented this big fictional part of the book, which has to do with the murder of this Israeli writer, David Mellon, who's written a book about King David and presents him in the guise of a modern day Israeli gangster. And so my character kind of could do a lot of the thinking about that stuff that I was trying to do. And since the character was Israeli, he could do it in a way that had more authority in a way than I do as an American.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Tell me a little bit about, because this novel is told from several different points of view and different characters, and talk a little bit about accessing all of these voices, accessing these characters. Who gave you more problems, you know, if there were people that were harder to get into for you?
Yeah, it was fairly random in terms of which ones were more difficult. The ones that were most difficult were Meyer Lansky's first wife, Anne, seemed to be an important part of the story that I wanted to tell. I had a hard time with her. And I had a hard time with Lansky and his gangster cronies in the sort of like 20s up through the 40s, let's say. When he got to be an older man, I could imagine him much more easily. And I think that's probably because I didn't have as many stereotypes to work against. But it was hard for me to do dialogue of the 20s.
Yeah.
And there's some of that that's in the book, but not a heck of a lot. That was harder. Some of the things that were not so hard were things like writing an Israeli character, writing the narrator of the book is a woman journalist. And if I had thought about it too much, I might have made it hard for myself. But I kind of just didn't think about it. I just sort of tried to think about the story rather than so much about, you know, what gender they were, or what nationality they were.
Right, right. So it sounds like accessing a different time was harder than accessing a different place.
Yeah, that's true. Yeah. I learned while writing this book that, because I had written another book, Sway, which takes place in the 60s, and I felt pretty comfortable in the 60s. I could visualize it. What I'd realized with this book is that my imagination is not much good before 1950s. The sweet spot ends in the 50s somewhere. I don't know why.
I think it does for all of us.
Yeah.
50s was a sweet spot. That's funny. You know, having done memoir versus having done fiction, was the memoir more difficult given, you know, the circumstances that were born out of the memoir? Or, you know, do you find sort of solace in fiction, or did you find kind of the cathartic experience of the memoir more satisfying, or is it because you do this wonderful blend of fact and fiction, and I'm wondering if dealing with both of those, if there's one that you're more drawn to?
I think I'm more drawn to fiction, actually. It's the memoir was very hard because I was stuck with the facts, and the facts were really complex, and there were too many people. I mean, part of the book ended up being about this giant empire of land fraud and the many players involved in it and the connections to government and politics. It's kind of like a Chinatown story, and it's very complicated, and I was sort of stuck with it. If I had been a fiction writer writing about that subject, I would have simplified it a lot. Mm. And so fiction gives you some latitude. I don't think in the way that people maybe imagine right away, but it just gives you, first of all, it allows you access to other people and imagining their consciousness. And that's, you know, there's a lot of things about writing that I find very frustrating, and the sort of shrinking audience for literary fiction is one of them, but I still get a lot of satisfaction out of just, you know, giving myself access to the consciousnesses of other kinds of people, people that are not like me.
Yeah.
There's, you know, you could do worse with your life, I guess.
Right, right. Right. My guest this morning is Zachary Lazar, the book I Pity the Poor Immigrant. I love the photos in here. Was that always part of it, or did you decide to layer those in afterwards? Because they're very telling. Some of them are lovely in their graphicness.
Well, thanks so much. Thank you. You know, because some people like them and some people don't like them. I took most of them. And some people urge me to take them out of the book, actually. I like them. I mean, they're, you know, many of them have the kind of snapshot sloppiness to them that either you like it or you don't like it. But I think it adds a nice atmosphere. And sometimes some perhaps much-needed humor in this book. There's a photograph of the space in Israel where supposedly David and Goliath squared off, and you can, there's a picture of the creek bed where David would have picked up the stone that he used in his sling. And in that picture are there stones, but there's also like a crumpled up Lay's potato chip bag or something, and it kind of has this neat effect to me.
Yeah. These wonderful sort of textures of everyday life, right, that are...
Yeah, exactly.
The modern and the more great juxtapositions, the Lay's potato chip bag next to, the stones where David and Goliath battled it out. That's so great. Tell me a little bit about your revision process, because once you had, I don't know if you wrote it linearly all the way through and then kind of looked at what you had and massaged it from there, but it strikes me as sort of a, you know, complicated book to put together. Tell me a little bit about how you went about doing that.
Yeah, it was complicated. I always started what I think at least is going to be page one and just try to write my way through, and then find myself frequently shifting the order of things. And the way I write nowadays is I always have two files open on my little computer. One is the draft, and the other one is all the junk that I cut out of it. Because I've learned over time that a lot of times if you cut something, it might be really kind of dead or inert in one spot, and then if you plug it in somewhere else, suddenly it snaps back to life. So I do a lot of juggling things around, and I'll write a chapter, polish it, then start the next one, polish both of those two, then start the third one, et cetera. So it's this kind of back and forth process for me. Mm-hmm. So I'm revising a lot of the time before I move forward.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Which is nice, because then I don't know. I mean, I would think that if you wrote 800 pages of this and then tried to sit down and put it all together, it would be overwhelming.
Yeah, it would.
Yeah.
I mean, I, one of the things I do for my research, for example, is look at court documents and things like that, which are, you know, 600 pages or 800 pages. And there is a story in there somewhere, but it gets so muddled. It gives you a lot of headaches trying to untangle it.
Yeah, right. Sadly, we're drawing down on our time. Is there wisdom or writing advice that we should have covered that we haven't yet covered for writers?
Oh, just the cliche that perseverance is way more important than talent, and that you just have to, if you love it, you just have to keep doing it.
Dang it! No shortcuts.
Yeah.
And where do we find you online if people are looking for you?
Oh, I have a bad website, ZacharyLazar.com.
A bad website.
Or they can find me on the Tulane website, Tulane.edu.
Perfect. And all of your books are out and available for purchase.
They are.
Zach, this was a huge pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time this morning.
Thank you so much.
That was Zachary Lazar. The book, I Pity the Poor Immigrant, published by Little Brown, is out and available now. That's unfortunately all the time we have for today. Barbara will be back here with you next Wednesday morning. So until next week, thanks so much for joining us. Have a great day.